Well, if you're like me, you like to sit down to a good mystery to read. Larry Mueller here again, and my guests have put together a dandy, Betsy Drain and Michael Hinden, here to talk about the latest addition to their series. They've got a series of Nora Barnes and Tony Sandler, a mystery series. The latest is called Death on a Starry Night. The other books we talked with them about, Murder in Lascaux. I don't believe we talked about that one together, but we did talk about The Body in Bodega Bay. They are professors emeriti of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and maybe you've read one of their previous books. I think we're going to talk about the latest and certainly answer your questions and comments. Love to hear from you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Betsy Drain, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
And I tell you what, it's nice to see you, Michael Hinden. Thank you for coming by as well.
Happy to be here.
Well, it's always fun to talk about your books. And this latest, I think this is your best one. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Well, thank you.
That's good to hear. You always want to feel that you're learning how to do it better each time.
Well, I tell you what, you've done a good job with this one. And set the stage for us, the background of the book and what's going on.
Well, the background of the book was a biography of Van Gogh that came out a couple of years ago, written by two scholars named Naifa and Smith. And they had a bombshell theory that Van Gogh hadn't committed suicide, but in fact had been the victim of a homicide. And this sounded fascinating. So we began digging into it. And it became such an interesting story that I said to Betsy, you know, this is a great idea for our next mystery, digging into the death of Vincent van Gogh as a backstory and setting the book during a scholarly conference where scholars are arguing about the death of Van Gogh, and one of them doesn't make it to the end of the conference herself.
No, barely gets to the conference, right. As a matter of fact. And then it's the whodunit from there. And, you know, I think, talk about the setting. Part of the book that I really enjoy.
I was thinking that could be the answer to your first question, too, because actually before Michael or I ever began reading about Van Gogh, Michael's idea of this book was generating because he was in France 50 years ago as a singing waiter.
Oh, my goodness.
At a cafe that overlooked the very fountain where our victim is found. So, Michael, why don't you tell about that adventure and how it led us to go back to Saint Paul de Vence, uh-huh. the little town where Michael had been the waiter, and to look at it not as just a tourist place or a beautiful place that Michael had been in the past, but as a setting for the murder.
Yeah.
Well, this was a long time ago. I spent my junior year studying in Paris. And the following summer, I hitchhiked down to the Riviera and ended up getting a job as a waiter in this little restaurant in this beautiful medieval village of Saint-Paul-de-Vence. It's got, you know, walls around it, and it looks unchanged from the Middle Ages, except for the tourists. And I spent that summer looking out at this beautiful fountain and dreaming of not coming back and finishing school, staying in France, becoming a writer, and writing a book in which a body is discovered in that fountain. And by gosh, it took me 50 years.
You were actually thinking about it back then.
I was. I wrote a letter home. My father said, you're coming back and you're going to finish school and you're going to forget about this dopey idea of yours. And I did.
Oh, well, I tell you what, the descriptions that you have, I mean, it's clear that you really like the place a lot, Betsy.
Well, love makes you pay attention. You know, a mother or father knows that about their own child. You look with a kind of intensity at something you love. And we both feel that way about France in general, but in particular this region and that town. So when we went back, there's another thing. When you have a project for something, you also look at it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that we went into places and saw them with a different eye. Michael's talking about the fountain. When I walked up to the top of the town and wandered into the cemetery and found there that there was a tomb to a great artist. And I found myself, you know, gazing at it, and then came back another week, and someone had put a glass blown heart, red, all completely red, about the size of an apple or of a heart, maybe, right on top of this tomb. And I just felt that sense of the love of art. And pretty soon I was inventing how our characters could go up to that cemetery and how Nora could see that from the point at which you get to the cemetery, you could also get on top of a wall. And that's the wall that runs around the entire town, the ramparts of the town. And that led us to Toby walking those ramparts at night and to our second attempted murder. You know, we really do love our settings. And I think, and Michael has said the same, that the settings, in a sense, are what inspire our fiction.
Yeah.
You know, just it comes out of where we're visiting.
You mentioned the names, Nora and Toby. They've been in all three. They're the people. Where do they come from?
Well, you know, we're both academics, so it was natural that we would have one of our characters. We thought, we go back to Nick and Nora's old films from the beginning of mystery films. I think that must have popped into our mind as we could write about a couple. And the name Nora happens to be a name that I have loved ever since I was a kid. So we came up with that. You just said Toby right away, and I said, Toby? Where does that name come from?
What made you think Toby? I can't remember. It just sort of popped into my head, and I said, I picture him being called Toby, which is kind of a fun name, I've always thought. He's a lighthearted guy, and Nora has a tendency to fret and worry and to be serious, especially worried about her sister, who's got some problems, and her family members. And so we thought Toby would be a kind of nice balance to keep the narration from getting too gloomy.
Well, you know what? Actually, they're kind of a nice couple. You could see how they would fit together pretty well, actually. We're talking today with Betsy Drayton and Michael Hinden, who have a new book out. It's called Death on a Starry Night, visiting with them about the book and about their travels. The book is set in France, and it's a wonderful setting. And just reading about the countryside and reading about some of the artists that they kind of feature in the book, it's really a lot of fun for me. You may have a question about the book or about writing. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. Well, now, before we go to the phones, are you Van Gogh fans? I assume so.
Yes. I mean, we're art lovers, and who doesn't like Van Gogh? I mean, his story is so poignant. He was a total failure during his life, and he's probably everybody's favorite artist now.
And he had little money, as I remember.
He was living on nothing.
Desperately poor. He was basically supported by his brother, who'd send him some cash in the mail, and that's what he lived on. He didn't sell his paintings. Toward the end of his life, a fellow artist gave him a small amount for one of his paintings. But he never sold paintings. He was totally destitute, very unhappy. And, of course, there's the legend that he was so miserable that he took his own life, which is the sort of starting point, as I mentioned a little while ago.
Yeah, there's a letter involved in the story itself, which I thought was really cool. And I had a miserable time trying to... And I never did figure out until the... I never figured out who did it. I had to read about it in the end. Mike and Greenbush, your turn. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I have four books floating in my head, and I have never written anything other than just expository in college. I don't have confidence. I don't have the story. There's some family legends that are just unbelievable that I wanted to write. Where do I start, and who do I contact?
Mm-hmm. Well, you start by writing, that's for sure. If I were you, I'd outline, just start by writing down the elements of what you want to write about and then get it in a kind of outline form as you move along. You know, and that takes a little while to happen. But if you can get it organized like that, then you can show it to someone who'll give you encouragement, maybe somebody who'll give you some, tell you what is interesting about it, because that's what's helpful for somebody to identify, oh, you have a story here. This part of the story will connect with people, whereas a part you might have thought was interesting, they won't feel so forcefully. And then go from there. I mean, getting a publisher is very hard, but getting for a first writer, it's really best to write the whole thing. Some people differ on that, but I think most people who are published artists and authors now and are familiar with the publishing market realize a first author has to have a full manuscript. But that doesn't mean that you don't show your work to anybody until you're finished. I mean, really, I think it would be great to have feedback from somebody, maybe somebody in your family who might know the story, and then some people outside who are going to represent readers who don't know your family story. And I just want to encourage you. It's a real joy to do something different from what you've done all the rest of your life for your job.
We'll take a break, and we'll be back and talk some more about that. Stay with us. We have a good mystery to put on your reading list today. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With me, Betsy Drain and Michael Hinden. They're here to talk about the latest edition of their Nora Barnes and Toby Sandler mystery series. This one's called Death on a Starry Night, and they are professors emeriti of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Have been with me. We talked about their previous book, The Body in Badoga Bay, and had a lot of fun with that and having some fun today talking about their latest book. I hope you'll join in the conversation. Maybe you have a question about writing, maybe a question about the book, or even about some of the people who are featured in the book. Van Gogh is, of course, featured in it. We're set in France. The story set in France. And it's a lovely setting for murder to take place. So join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And, you know, I think it'd be fun to have you, Michael, read a little bit from the book to give people sort of the flavor of it. So can you go ahead and do that for us?
Sure. There are actually two voices in the book. Mm-hmm. One is set in the present, and that's the voice of Nora, who's narrating the novel. And the other is a voice from the past in the form of a document. So we'll give you just a bit of a flavor of the two voices.
That's wonderful. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to shoot him. I can still see him, clutching his side, and looking at me like a wounded animal. He kicked over his easel and stumbled to his knees. The painting he was working on fell to the ground. Later, they said he shot himself, but that isn't true. I did it. I wanted to help him, but instead I killed him. And I've been sorry for it all my life.
Oh, boy. Well, let's continue. Let's go with the second part of this, Betsy.
A Starry Night. It seemed made to order for the opening of a Van Gogh conference. And what location could be more idyllic? Not far from the beaches of the French Riviera, the village of Saint-Paul-de-Vence is stacked upon a dramatic hilltop, its stone houses encircled by medieval walls. In summer, the town is a beehive swarming with tourists. Tonight, in mid-December, all was quiet as we climbed the steep cobblestone street into the village. It was the dinner hour. Clear and cold, I could see my breath. The shops that lined the pedestrian streets looked closed for the season, and many of the houses were shuttered. We reached the crest of the hill and stopped to admire an old stone fountain shaped like a Grecian urn. Spigots dripped water into a basin with a rim high enough to sit on. Toward the top of the urn, a decorative fringe suggested a laurel wreath. I think of it now as a funeral urn, for an image of death clings to that lovely stonework fountain. But that evening, all was serene.
That's a wonderful, wonderful start, and that's the start of the book.
That's the start of the book.
It's great. Helen in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Yes, I do have a question. I've read your books and I love them, and I have a question kind of about the process, which is interesting to hear about two people writing a book together. So, how do you collaborate on a book like this?
Good question.
Thanks, Helen. We started out having ideas that we bounced around over wine and a beautiful dinner in France, you know, and then at home when we were missing France. But getting it onto paper required a lot of trust. You know, we had to trust that we were going to be able to develop this story together. So we developed the habit of getting our idea for a plot going, and then having one of us start an outline. And then we would look over what the other one had done and make suggestions. And it got to be our habit eventually that Michael was the one who would write down the outline. I was the one who would be criticizing and tearing it apart and giving him more ideas. But then what he built became the scaffolding for a book. And what I would bring to the beginning of the process was filling out the characters, bringing them from being a character who's simply useful in a one-paragraph description of a chapter as, say, the person who would get the murderer to the scene, and to develop that into a full personality. And I would have page or two page, sometimes three pages, about that character to bring to Michael before he then went on and developed more of the outline. And finally, we'd have the two things: finished outline, finished a description of characters, and then whoever wanted to do it would sit down and write the first scene, usually maybe 8 pages, 6 pages, something like that. The second person would sit down, revise it all, and go on and write their own next scene, so that in the course of the book, we wrote and rewrote each other's writing, our own writing, until we have it as smoothly won as we can do.
And sometimes, if I go back and read a book a year later, I can't quite remember who wrote the particular passage.
It's not possible to tie. There's no change in the... You've done a marvelous job of that. You really could not tell that there were two different people writing this.
Well,
thanks.
Thank you. We've worked hard on it, and that only comes from going back and forth and sharing and editing and re-editing. It's a long process, but the more we've written, the easier I think it's become.
I think with this book, and also when we've been starting the next one, that it's become more second nature to us both, I think. For me, I find that when I'm in the world of Toby and Nora, that now I have the sound of mm-hmm. our books in my head. And so I write out of that and don't mm-hmm. so much have to be corrected by you that, no, that's not the way.
Toby wouldn't say that or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. We've right. got that more in the back of my minds now.
So it's almost as if by now we've invented a new joint writing style, which is a little different from each one of us writing in his or her personal style. And particularly in the first book, we kept trying to unlearn all the habits we had developed as academics. Because one thing about academic writing is it usually doesn't go quickly.
Yeah. Well, this probably doesn't go real. How long does it take to put a book like this together?
I guess from beginning of an idea to correcting the final proofs, about a 2-year process, I would say. We don't work on it every day. We sort of work in spurts. A couple of weeks might go by and neither one of us has picked it up, and then we sort of concentrate and dig in and work intensely.
Oh, well, that's a marvelous explanation of that. I really appreciate that call. By the way, as you listen, you may have a question or comment as well. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. A couple of the things that I... The sort of the little side things that happened, I enjoyed a lot. Your writing about the food was wonderful. I enjoyed that a lot. And then different little pieces of information that I got that I didn't know about. Maybe it was Van Gogh or Renoir. I think there's a you go to Renoir's. Was it his home? Or
he went to his home, which was his studio in his old age. He finally made enough money. He did make... He was never poor like Van Gogh, but he made enough money to build a really beautiful house on a lovely piece of property overlooking the bay of Cagnes-sur-Mer, which is near Cannes. So it was a beautiful piece of property. And we have our characters go there to tour the house the way we did, to look at the art. And in that space, we bring people together who could be suspects as pairs. And what we wound up doing afterwards we could see was that we could really feel a sort of lusty persona of Renoir. Everybody remembers his fleshy maidens, you know, which he really in real life had surrounding him. He always had a lot of beautiful women being the servants and the people who helped him. And he was at the stage where he was in a wheelchair and at the very end painting with his paintbrush bolted to his arm so that he could move it even though he was so arthritic. But he still had these gorgeous women around him, and that's what he was painting, these women. So we wound up coming out of that scene were suggestions about who might be having an affair with whom, and that kind of delicious suggestion that you feel sometimes in the face of Renoir's paintings.
And I didn't know, you know, so there were things that I didn't know that he had his hand literally. There was, what did he have, a brace or something?
It was wrapped, yes. He had a brace.
There was a short film on a loop that they played when you visited his house, and you saw him painting for a couple of minutes in his old age with his hands wrapped up tight in bandages, giving him so that he had a firm grip on a brush, which ordinarily he couldn't hold. Well, you know, this isn't central to the plot of
no,
the murder.
No, but it was interesting.
It's interesting. And I know that as a reader, if I pick up a novel, I'm picking it up to be entertained primarily. But I also like learning little things along the way. And if an author can give that information to me while I'm being entertained, I usually enjoy the book all the more. So that's something I think we've tried to do in our writing as well.
Well, I think, and it really does add so much to the book. And even there's a scene where they go to a perfume factory, which I thought, well, this is interesting. You know, this is our, and, you know, not such good things happen there, which we don't need to talk about those bad things, but it's a perfect setting for something bad to happen in a way. But then just the whole side story of how they were describing and had people try the perfumes.
Well, the Fragonard Perfume Factory really is there in a town near Vence, and it's also really located next to the Museum of the Artist Fragonard. So we were able to bring our group up there to actually supposedly look at the museum, but they go on the wrong day, and they have to then go to the perfume factory instead. And it's someplace that we had visited in the past, and when we got the idea of having a poisoning be involved in our murder, we thought, hey, maybe it could be one of those perfumes from up there in the Haida. What's the name of the town, Michael? I'm forgetting.
Grasse.
Grasse, in the town of Grasse. And it was so much fun to go back there and look at it from that point of view. How could a murder occur here? And it was fun, too, as it is with almost everything we do in all the books. We try to have the setting be accurate to reality, except for the pieces that we're fictionalizing. Mm-hmm. So I managed to do a little research there on the spot, and then took home their brochures, and we managed to use even the names of the perfumes are all real names of perfumes that we have conversation revolve around, except for the one that kills somebody, because we wouldn't want to defame a perfume. But it does really help create those ideas that the book runs on, and also deepen them and give them atmosphere when we go to a place and we observe something closely. Another example is we go to the Matisse Chapel. The group goes to the Matisse Chapel, which is one of the most extraordinarily, lushly beautiful places in the world. And Matisse even thought of it as his masterpiece, a chapel, instead of one of his paper cuttings or one of his oil paintings. And we went there, and, you know, we're focusing on the beauty of it the way you usually do. But then there was this little, not very well framed, old newspaper clipping that told the story of the woman who answered an ad to be his, as it said in the ad, pretty young nurse. She answered the ad and became the nurse for Matisse. And then there's some suggestion of maybe an attraction between them, and she ran away and became a nun. And so that was a little story that we could use to parallel the story of our character Angie, who runs away and becomes a nun because of trouble with men.
So the trick is not to write a travelogue, but to use interesting locales and to integrate them with the plot and your development of character. So usually that's what we try to do in that instance, and also the perfume factory.
Well, and the thing about the perfume factory, that part of the story, I was not expecting what happens. I'm reading along here, oh, this is really interesting about how they sample these perfumes and everything, and then suddenly, oh, hell breaks loose, kind of, in a way. And so that, it was a, kind of a perfect pairing, I guess, of that particular instance and being at that place, and then here comes death. So that was, to me, I thought, wow, this is...
You know, I think back to such a lecture he used to give on T.S. Eliot, and he said about... he had a lot of intellectual material in his poems and references, and he said, well, those pieces are like the meat that you throw to the dog when you go in to steal the jewels of the house. The person's brain is operating on, as you say, elements about the factory, you know, where the women are and how it's separated from this and that machine, while you're really getting to the emotive heart of the mystery, you know, something bad's going to happen.
Well, it was perfect. We've talked about the two primary characters, and you mentioned Angie, who is You kind of hope she has a happy ending somewhere down right. the road.
The sister,
the sister who is going to become a nun or thinks she's going to be a nun.
Well, we love that character. She's kind of our favorite character besides, of course. In fact, she's almost, for me, more of a favorite character than Nora and Toby. She adds something different to the thing that they bring to every book. And she wasn't in the first draft of the first book at all. And got brought in. The caller was asking earlier about how to get started writing, and we sent a draft in to a potential editor, and he wrote back that, well, you know, Nora needs more texture to her. She can't just be somebody who's observing everything and you don't know much about her. You just see the mystery that she sees. We need to put something in there for her. And so we decided that she could have issues over her family, over mm-hmm. her sister, that we could bring into the first book. And then now it's gone through. She's developed into a character that we had not envisioned at all at the beginning.
Well, it's she really is an interesting character. It's somebody you'd like to meet. Well, they're all people you'd like to meet for sure. The one of the people that I liked was somebody that's probably not going to be in your any future books, Lieutenant Monique Auclair.
Yes, yeah.
She was an interesting. She leads the police investigation and doesn't play. She's not in there a lot, but when she is,
right. I mean, if you are dealing with an amateur sleuth, you have to decide what is the relationship between your amateur sleuth and the local police authorities. And it's almost become a cliche in so many murder mysteries that it's antagonistic. But we consciously wanted to do something a little different. Mm-hmm. So it's a cooperative relationship in this particular case. And Nora works closely with the lieutenant to supply information that only she has access to help the investigation.
And I liked the way she developed into such a competent character mm-hmm. with a lot of reserve, but very competent, observing things well, and leading the investigation well. Because I wanted to combine that with the elements of a beautiful French woman that are kind of iconic, you know, beautiful, stylish clothes, and keeping the figure, and all the sort of cool demeanor mm-hmm. that we think of French women as having, but to combine that with a show of a French woman could also be highly competent at her job, a job that women didn't used to do decades
past. And I did like the fact that the people who were under her showed her respect, yeah. and obviously she was the boss, and there wasn't, to me, I like that a lot, that they didn't, there wasn't some little side story about her not being appreciated or respected by her. The people that she was working with were all men. The rest of them were all men, but they all obviously respected her, and so I'm glad you portrayed her that way.
Well, thanks.
You're working on another book already.
Yes, and the next book is going to be set in Ireland.
Oh.
And in fact, we just came back from a 2-week trip to scout out locations, so we're thinking about it.
And in the meantime, Death on a Starry Night, and oh, I wanted to mention, you're going to be reading on September 14th at 7 p.m. in Madison at the Sequoia Library. You'll be doing a reading there, September 14th at 7 p.m. You're good readers, by the way, so I'm sure it's going to be fun for people to hear that. I wanted to mention that as well. I almost completely forgot. So September 14th, 7 p.m., Sequoia Library in Madison. And I'm glad to hear the book's doing well.
Thanks.
It's always a pleasure to visit with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. The book is called Death on a Starry Night. I really enjoyed it. I think you will, too. Betsy Drain and Michael Hinden, the authors, and always a pleasure to talk with them. And frankly, it's always a pleasure to have you listening in today. And every day, as a matter of fact. Scott Craven joins us tomorrow. In the meantime, there is lots more in store, so I hope you will stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.